32. The Wave. Even in that moment of shock, Norton's first concern was for his ship.
"Endeavour," he called. "Situation report?"
"All okay, Skipper," was the reassuring answer from Exec. "We felt a slight tremor, but nothing that could cause any damage. There's been a small change of attitude. The bridge says about 0.2 degrees. They also think the spin rate has altered slightly. We'll have an accurate reading on that in a couple of minutes."
"So it's beginning to happen," Norton said to himself. "And a lot earlier than we expected. We're still a long way from perihelion and the logical time for an orbit change. But some kind of trim was undoubtedly taking place, and there might be more shocks to come." Meanwhile, the effects of this first one were all too obvious, up there on the curving sheet of water that seemed perpetually falling from the sky. The wave was about 10 kilometers away, and stretched the full width of the sea from northern to southern shore. Near the land, it was a foaming wall of white, but in deeper water, it was a barely visible blue line, moving much faster than the breakers on either flank. The drag of the shoreward shallows was already bending it into a bow, with the central portion getting farther and farther ahead.
"Sergeant," said Norton urgently,
"this is your job. What can we do?"
Sergeant Barnes had brought the raft completely to rest and was studying the situation intently. Her expression, Norton was relieved to see, showed no trace of alarm. Rather, a certain zestful excitement, like that of a skilled athlete about to accept a challenge.
"I wish we had some soundings," she said. "If we're in deep water, there's nothing to worry about."
"Then we're all right. We're about 4 kilometers from shore."
"I hope so, but I want to study the situation."
She applied power again and swung Resolution around until it was just underway, heading directly toward the approaching wave. Norton judged that the swiftly moving central portion would reach them in less than 5 minutes, but he could also see that it presented no serious danger. It was only a racing ripple a fraction of a meter high, and would scarcely rock the boat. The walls of foam, lagging far behind it, were the real menace. Suddenly, in the very center of the sea, a line of breakers appeared. The wave had clearly hit a submerged wall, several kilometers in length, not far below the surface. At the same time, the breakers on the two flanks collapsed as they ran into deeper water.
"Anti-slosh plates," Norton told himself. "Exactly the same as in Endeavour's own propellant tanks, but on a thousandfold greater scale. There must be a complex pattern of them all around the sea, to damp out any waves as quickly as possible. The only thing that matters now is, are we right on top of one?"
Sergeant Barnes was one jump ahead of him. She brought Resolution to a full stop and threw out the anchor. It hit bottom at only 5 meters.
"Haul it up," she called to her crewmates. "We've got to get away from here."
Norton agreed heartily. But in which direction? The sergeant was headed full speed toward the wave, which was now only 5 kilometers away. For the first time, he could hear the sound of its approach, a distant, unmistakable roar, which he had never expected to hear inside Rama. Then it changed in intensity. The central portion was collapsing again, and the flanks again were building up. He tried to estimate the distance between the submerged baffles, assuming that they were spaced at equal intervals. If he was right, there should be one more to come. If they could station the raft in the deep water between them, they would be perfectly safe. Sergeant Barnes cut the motor and threw out the anchor again. It went down 30 meters without hitting bottom.
"We're okay," she said, with a sigh of relief. "But I'll keep the motor running."
Now,
there were only the lagging walls of foam along the coast. Out here in the central sea, it was calm again, apart from the inconspicuous blue ripple still speeding toward them. The sergeant was just holding resolution on course toward the disturbance, ready to pour on full power at a moment's notice. Then, only 2 kilometers ahead of them, the sea started to foam once more. It humped up in white-maned fury, and now its roaring seemed to fill the world. Upon the 16-kilometer high wave of the cylindrical sea, a smaller ripple was superimposed, like an avalanche thundering down a mountain slope. And that ripple was quite large enough to kill them. Sergeant Barnes must have seen the expressions on the faces of her crewmates. She shouted above the roar, "What are you scared about? I've ridden bigger ones than this." That was not quite true. Nor did she add that her earlier experience had been in a well-built surf boat, not an improvised raft. "But if we have to jump, wait until I tell you. Check your life jackets." She's magnificent, like a Viking warrior going into battle, and obviously enjoying every minute, thought the commander. And she's probably right, unless we've miscalculated badly. The wave continued to rise, curving upward and over. The slope above them probably exaggerated its height, but it looked enormous, an irresistible force of nature that would overwhelm everything in its path. Then, within seconds, it collapsed, as if its foundations had been pulled out from underneath it. It was over the submerged barrier, in deep water again. When it reached them a minute later, resolution merely bounced up and down a few times before Sergeant Barnes swung her around and set off at top speed toward the north. "Thanks, Ruby. That was splendid. But will we get home before it comes around for the second time?" "Probably not. It will be back in about 20 minutes, but it will have lost all its strength then. We'll scarcely notice it." Now that the wave had passed, they could relax and enjoy the voyage, though no one would be completely at ease until they were back on land. The disturbance had left the water swirling in random eddies, and had also stirred up a most peculiar acidic smell, like crushed ants, as Jimmy put it well. Though unpleasant, the odor caused none of the attacks of seasickness that might have been expected. It was something so alien that human physiology could not respond to it. A minute later, the wave front hit the next underwater barrier as it climbed away from them and up the sky. This time, seen from the rear, the spectacle was unimpressive, and the voyagers were ashamed of their previous fears. They began to feel themselves masters of the cylindrical sea. The shock was therefore all the greater when, not more than 100 meters away, something like a slowly rotating wheel began to rear up out of the water. Glittering metallic spokes, 5 meters long, emerged dripping, spun for a moment in the fierce Raman glare, and splashed back. It was as if a giant starfish with tubular arms had broken the surface. At first sight, it was impossible to tell whether it was an animal or a machine. Then it flopped over and lay half awash, bobbing up and down in the gentle aftermath of the wave. Now they could see that there were 9 arms, apparently jointed, radiating from a central disc. 2 of the arms were broken, snapped off at the outer joint. The others ended at a complicated collection of manipulators that reminded Jimmy strongly of the crab he had encountered. The 2 creatures came from the same line of evolution, or the same drawing board. At the middle of the disc was a small turret, bearing 3 large eyes. 2 were closed, one open, and even that appeared to be blank and unseeing. No one doubted that they were watching the death throes of some strange monster tossed up to the surface by the submarine disturbance that had just passed. Then they saw that it was not alone. Swimming around it and snapping at its still feebly moving limbs were two small beasts like overgrown lobsters. They were efficiently chopping up the monster, and it did nothing to resist, though its own claws seemed quite capable of dealing with the attackers. Again, Jimmy was reminded of the crab that had demolished Dragonfly. He watched intently as the one-sided conflict continued, and quickly confirmed his impression.
"Look, Skipper," he whispered. "Do you see? They're not eating it. They don't even have any mouths. They're simply chopping it to pieces. That's exactly what happened to Dragonfly."
"You're right. They're dismantling it like a broken machine." Norton wrinkled his nose. "But no dead machine ever smelled like that." Then another thought struck him. "My God, suppose they start on us. Ruby, get us back to shore as quickly as you can."
Resolution surged forward with reckless disregard for the life of her power cells. Behind them, the nine spokes of the great starfish, they could think of no better name for it, were clipped steadily shorter, and presently the weird tableau sank back into the depths of the sea. There was no pursuit, but they did not breathe comfortably again until Resolution had drawn up to the landing stage, and they had stepped thankfully ashore. As he looked back across that mysterious and now sinister band of water, Norton grimly determined that no one would ever sail it again. There were too many unknowns, too many dangers. He looked back upon the towers and ramparts of New York and the dark cliff of the continent beyond. They were safe now from inquisitive man. He would not tempt the gods of Rama again.